It's Wednesday, 21st August, and it's 10:30. The topic is Java 8 and the future of Java, complexity, readability in future Java.
So, welcome to the future of Java session. The major idea what I was proposing this topic was to discuss the big changes from Java 8. So I think lambdas and syntax changes are quite serious things for the average developer. Yeah, somebody's taking notes. Okay, must volunteer.
I have no pen. If somebody has a pen, then I will put in the
pen. Am I ready?
Okay. I think this is a good idea. Readability is gone worse. Should Java go further on doing such things like lambda? What do you expect from the future? So just getting ideas, discussing all those things that are out there, and people saying, well, that's not Java anymore. So, yeah. So don't expect any answers. I just have questions.
Well, since my name is also there, yeah. I might say what my motivation was to start this and what drove me to that is pretty much along the same lines. But I do have a practical problem. I deal regularly. I work in enterprise environment for larger customers, and normally deal with large code base in Java that was written over the course of many years. Current projects were started in 1999, and some of the code base is still from 1999, and so 14 years old now, and it was written by developers of various degrees and skills. Sometimes we work with onshore, sometimes we do a lot with offshore development. So something like peer review is per se not an option because we buy chunks of work, for example. And what I'm all the time looking for is how can I reduce, we mentioned this in several other discussions, how can I reduce all of the boilerplate code and make language more expressive so that when I, because I also cannot force people to write documentation, for example, how can I make the language short, expressive, powerful? What can be done with that in the future? One topic is breaking it down into modules. One topic is just achieving more with less coding, and maybe assuming more, maybe having been forced more, and so on. For example, yes, lambdas can save huge amount of code and add to the expressiveness of the language a great deal. Something very trivial like saying catch exception, this exception is this piece of code. That was already a great thing. Very simple stuff. And what are other things that are coming our way that could contribute to this? Because what I'm looking for is how can I say that I would like to see in the code 90% of functional code and 10% of boilerplate code. And today, in most of the projects that I deal with, it's 20% functional and 80% is shuffling, handling exceptions, dealing with collections, creating XML outputs, and all of that stuff.
When you say functional, you mean the main code, not functional.
Main code, business functional.
Yeah.
Business functional.
So the main code.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The stuff without the ceremony.
Because now with Java 8, function needs to be something else. Now we have functions.
Exactly. So then
code with no ceremony.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of that mix is more than just features of the language. I mean, there are certain features of language that might encourage people to avoid doing that, or encourage them to use them, but at the same time, you also think about, well, why is there so much boilerplate code in your application? And often, it's not... So many applications I see have huge amounts of boilerplate code that just don't need to be there. My general broad discussion on that is just, it's usually start with, well, how can we remove stuff from this code? How can we take out things that this application is doing? How easy is it to remove things rather than thinking about, well, how easy is it to add things? And good maintenance. So I've worked on a lot of projects where half the jars in the project weren't used at all. Right? People used them at one point, they're not referenced. And I worked on one project where a third of jars could be eliminated by just organizing the imports. So the only place that were ever referenced were an import. So there's a whole maintenance issue. And bringing in new features can encourage developers to rewrite code to use those features. And then in that process, you end up dropping lots of boilerplate code. So often, one of the big benefits of Spring initially was, well, by providing a tool set and then encouraging people to use it, you extracted out a lot of the value and then discarded a lot of old code that effectively got rewritten. My view is, well, you could have done that in Java. You could have done exactly the same exercise in Java for extracting out. It's the process that this change triggers can be often more valuable than the actual change itself.
And I'll pick up the added burden of having to code in XML.
Exactly. So yes. So that's why I prefer doing DSLs in Java. I could see that because for me initially I could figure out what the benefit of Spring was, and then I later saw it in real projects that what it did was it triggered a change which was better at least than what they had. And certainly Lambdas will do that. It will trigger developers to rewrite the code, think about the code again, and hopefully in the process eliminate some code. Although I also feel that you don't have to wait for Lambdas for that to happen. Anything that will encourage developers to redo their code, rewrite it, think about it in a new way, will be enough to reduce the code. And certainly some of the offshore code that I've seen has been most verbose I've ever come across. It's incredible. One example was an application was spending most of its time rounding a double that didn't need to be rounded, except that it was doing it writing it to text, and then parsing it as using double string, and then when that didn't seem to be quite enough, it also did its own writing to text using its own algorithm, and then decoding it again using its own algorithm. And because there was a bug in the way it was doing the decoding, it's actually worse than doing nothing at all. Ended up just using math.round, and that was enough. But it was an incredible amount of code to read through. How do you stop developers doing that? I'm not entirely sure, other than to drill into them that many senior developers, when they join a project or they're on a project, will spend a large percentage of their time removing code that other developers have written. And that,
so they have really low productivity. They're not creating anything.
Yeah, they actually have negative line commit in many cases.
We went through this exercise trying to measure reuse, and it was years ago, it was in Smalltalk actually, and finally the manager forced us to come up with a single number, and I said, what happens if I refactor this particular framework and we end up with fewer lines of code? That means our reuse numbers are going to go down even though the quality of the code base has gone up, right? And he looked at us and says, that can happen? Yeah, certainly. Yes, exactly. And sure enough, a couple of weeks later, project came in and said, part of the fork was refactoring, and we just squished this framework down to about a third of its original size by doing a lot of the things that Peter's saying, like you know, putting in missing abstractions, reorganizing code, making the method smaller, more reusable, you know, all these types of things. And at the end of the day, like I said, we ended up with about a third of the code base, and of course all our metrics got worse. And, you know, my comment when I first heard the exercise was, you know, whose bonus depends upon this, and how much of it can I get if I get the right number? And
Generation code for you.
And you know, and he ended up missing his bonus because we refactored that.
To me, that sounds like two orthogonal things. One is the tool set, Java, and how it's developing. The other thing is how we use it.
What do people see as a good thing? How are they being promoted? What are their bonuses driven by? It's all about, you know, what is the culture of promoting? You know, are you promoting, well, yes, you deliver this new thing each time, that's how you get paid, and so you're only ever going to add stuff, and then things will get added, and it grows organically.
But I guess the other point is that it doesn't, in this case, it didn't really matter what language. You can see the same problems in Java, you see the C++, you see the Smalltalk, see Perl, you know, Scala, whatever.
So what come with you from a Java side to enforce developers to do the stupid things? Or make it easier to do the good things?
To drill it into them that removing code and making it cleaner and refactoring is actually a value. Give them time to do that. Make them
make them read the specifications.
On one hand, we're discussing about craftsmanship. This is the skill of writing good code that needs to be learned, that's experienced, and so on. But on the other hand, it's easier if you have the tooling there that helps you or forces you to do some things.
What I'm saying is that a tooling isn't going to help you.
Java language, for example. A stupid example. I call a method. Why can't I say I call do something true, false, true? Why don't I write in this mode it's true? So why don't I use names parameters, for example? So when I read the code, I immediately see what it does. Oh, true, false, true. I need to go to Java doc, move the mouse over the method, or move the cursor over the method. See what this. What the first true is, what the first false is, what the second true is. Why don't I just write, this is true, that is false, something else is true. So I immediately see when I read the code, it becomes self-documenting immediately. Mm-hmm. That's great deal too, because they're easy to swap, first true and false. Just a very, very silly example. Yeah, that you'll find in some other languages.
I guess I'm not sure I completely understand the example that they've gotten. So I still think that in this case you're relying on tools when really what you need is good discipline from the developers.
If you give them good tools, they might necessarily use them.
I say create person. Name is Mike. Occupation is developer. City is Frankfurt. Otherwise, I write now Mike developer Frankfurt in the constructor. And passing three attributes, they are ordered.
Yes, I see what you mean. So there's no named arguments in constructors, and that would be
I'm just asking. This is what I'm
looking for example.
Yes.
What would happen if you swap them around?
I think it's a constructor object from a framework.
The framework is supposed to be name, position, surname, for example. But now, instead of passing that way, you pass it in name, surname, position.
Three strings.
Three things. That's string abuse, right?
Yeah.
So you should
maybe passing three objects is a stupid example.
It's a good example because
so what I'm saying is that would the name be simply a documentation thing? Or would if for example you say let's say it's name, salary, and position. Three of them. So if on a state you say position equals, then name equals, would it then automatically rearrange the arguments, or would it be the compiler?
For example, I declared my constructor as string name in salary and position.
Yes, sir.
And fine. And now I'm passing Kruno, 10,000 developer.
Yes.
What I would like to be able to say is, name is Kruno, position is developer. So I can also pass them the other way around.
There's a need for you to check for that. You use the default constructor, and then you can use instance initializer blocks. So like new person, parentheses, and then you do the squiggly, and then you do set name, and you know, name equals, salary equals
age. It's a lot of squigglies.
But can you get rid of the basic pattern? You can use a builder pattern. And with the builder, you say new person, name, Bruno, salary, build.
Why can't the can Java give me that?
So that's what I'm saying. With the initialized pattern, you get that. You just get two squigglies. Yes. It's so annoying, but sure.
So what do you guys think about effectively final?
You probably need to,
So basically in the past, if you wanted to access variable like your example,
like a local variable from within
from
anonymous in the class.
Or any inner class.
Especially
anonymous in the class.
Yes.
You need to make final.
Yes.
No, you don't need to anymore. But it's gotta be, you can't change it, so it's gotta be effective final, so that's what the final keyword is. So your example now of constructing actually would look neater because you don't have to go and make it fun.
Correct.
Yes. But it still has to be fun. That's one.
And it has to be effective fun. Is actually.
Well,
the
semantics of the program wouldn't be changed if you explicitly added a final keyword to every effectively final variable. So in other words, it's pure syntax.
I don't have to write this. Final. Yes, I will get an error if I change it somewhere.
Yes.
It's the job of the compiler guys to make this error as meaningful as possible, as verbose as possible. Yes. But I think in 90% of the case, this will not happen. So you will lose this final and you will be happy.
I love it.
Yes.
So this
is one great thing.
Sometimes you even calculate it somehow and it cannot be final. So you have to make a copy in the final in order to pass it. That's what you avoid. We didn't construct.
Well, no, the thing with the final, you still have to make a copy.
Yeah, you don't have to name a copy final.
So what I understood was that
if it changes before, you actually invoke it, and then you don't change it afterwards. It cannot change before the...
No, you have to resize another local variable.
And then this would be very interesting to explain that to
this is
new one of us, to saying, hey, in the history of the slider, now you don't need it, but you have to copy it.
I think Bill should have been, and then you should have a keyword to say that it's not fun.
Yeah.
Because developers will, by default, go to the whatever is the simplest to write, and certainly the simplest should have been final, and they should have a bar or whatever, and the things you actually want to change.
I think it's a good default to make it final. Yes.
I disagree. So Java 8 specifically sort of introduces two new mindsets, which is the asynchronous mindset, the completable future, the completion stage. Makes it a whole lot easier to do that, and on the other hand, it has all the new support for functional programming. So those are two sort of new mindsets. And if you have like an old code base, which is probably mostly like object-oriented-ish, if you take that, and then now with Java 8, you start introducing more synchronous programming in functional programming. How do you see that going?
I actually haven't seen a difference between OO programming and functional programming.
You haven't seen the difference?
I haven't seen a difference between OO.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because coming from a Smalltalk background, where code was objects and you're able to send message to code and do all kinds of things like that, right? To me, just bringing closures in language means that I can sort of get to something that looks like this, although it looks fairly ugly compared to what I'm used to, right? I'd really like to see code as an object in Java. But to me, that would eliminate the need for a lot of lambda syntax and other goofy things that happen that are going to like trip up developers. So for me, I don't see a difference between functional and object. It's just the way I think objects should have been done in the first place.
Because also in the object world, it's still right an inner class or anonymous inner class to handle what lambda is doing now for a lot of cases.
To me, like, one of the things when you work in a functional approach is, for example, you have a collection and you want to do filter, map filter, blah, those kind of things. You could do in Java as well with decorators-ish, but it's way easier to do now. It's way easier with Java 8.
Well, okay, so the Java APIs,
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
The Java APIs promote what I call externalization of internal state, right?
Yes.
And they also promote externalization of the management of Linux, of that state,
yeah.
Right? And that, to me, is not that's very something else, procedural, right? And so what I've actually seen is a lot of procedural code written in Java contained into class files, right?
Could you talk about the frameworks, JTE and things like that,
It's just across the board, and everybody does that, right? It's just completely across the board, right? We have the Java Beans specification, right? Get set.
Yeah.
That's an abomination, right? Because, I mean, Get seems to be reasonably okay, because at least I can still control internal state with a Get, but with the set seems reasonable because I can control internal state of the set. I can take a look at it and say, either reject it or convert it to the type I want it to be, internal representative one, or do something with it, right? So that I still have control of my internal state. As soon as I put a get in there, all bets are off. I no longer have control over what's happening internally inside this object, right? And to me, that's a bigger problem in the use of the language than this whole thing, right?
But
this whole thing of like injecting code to get something done, right? To me is like a really useful idea, because this is what we did in Smalltalk all the time. So we were going to run like a filter over a collection, but it's up to the collection to do it. It's responsibility.
But that's what we said before.
Things to the way that they should be.
No, I like that too. Function. I'm just wondering what's going to happen in these kind of code bases.
That's how people think. Mm. People will think it, not us. That's great, because I say, take stuff out of collection using this criteria.
Right.
This is this criteria. And that's my lambda. Yeah. And I can isolate that criteria in different class and have a set of one class that just contains all of my criteria in one place. Great.
Final is, you have to work extra hard to make things final. So the easy way of doing it, the right way of doing, which is what you're describing, is difficult in old style Java. That's what new thing.
No, I disagree.
It requires discipline, which is the difficult part, right?
No, you've been taught incorrectly. It's not that it's difficult. You've been taught wrong.
What you said, the right thing requires...
The right thing to filter a collection is to give it a piece of code that knows how to accept or reject stuff. And doing that in old-style Java, you have to create an object and pass that object in. And that's a lot of boilerplate for something that's actually just a comparison.
Like a comparator, right?
Which is a lot of boilerplate for doing something that...
So now we've complicated the language by putting in all this like complex wrappers around things that auto-generate anonymous
interfaces. Makes it much easier, much more readable.
I agree with you, but were you using comparators before? To inject the comparator into a collection to get out what you wanted.
You're doing it, but you have to do what works. And then you're coming back to that code. You see all the boilerplate.
Comparison was there from the beginning.
Right.
Only thing that was baked into the collections API stuff in that way, and everything else was not. Yeah. So you roll it off to something different if you wanted to do something like that, that we now get from the modified collections API, from the stream API, and from the new features how evolving interfaces. So there were just no way to get specific things onto the collections.
That's absolutely incorrect. The what happened with generics is we went into a direction that further encouraged people to actually go in and extract state, and then, because I do this regularly, you go into code bases and you basically invert
everything from doing gets to actually putting the responsibility into the class, you immediately implode the code base. Immediately, right? And it becomes a lot more readable and a lot cleaner. And if lambdas are going to do that, that's really good, but it's still an extra complicated syntax.
So what's the use of it? It's really simple.
Yeah.
Compared to generics, generics were quite hard to learn and to get right, and to a lot of weird edge cases.
Still are.
Lambdas, I mean, lambdas is...
The basic language facilities are very simple.
Yeah. Obviously you can go into complicated stuff, but, because this is my plug for IntelliJ, because if you use the latest IntelliJ and you open up the code, it says, hey, that's what it is, just replace the lambda, and you go, it's done.
Yeah.
It actually renders enormous amount of classes as well.
It makes them look
like you have to look quite carefully. It pulls away the little, it's not really a lander in the first
place. Right, exactly. It's just
enough to sugar over it.
What? That doesn't make any sense to say that. Why is a lambda? How can you say this is a lambda when it clearly is a lambda?
I'm not
curious about that. What is a lambda? That isn't a lambda.
Well, no, but I mean, it's not the lambda syntax. It's just an anonymous in a class that looks like a lambda.
Yes, but you're replaced with lambda. So,
yes.
So it shows the syntax of what it would look like with lambda. So you see, this is what it would look like, and then you...
I get your comment. It isn't a real lambda. And when later on they hugely improve the translation strategies for lambdas, your code will still be an anonymous in the class IntelliJ, will just make it look like a lambda.
But if you look at it, it looks like structured like a lambda. All the boilerplate disappeared, except that it's in a slightly different colour.
Because you're used to it gently, you don't have this massive, like,
yes. People are used to looking at it, even if it's not able to write it in, say, 6 or 7.
If compared to generics never did that. Generics, they would warn you and say, oh, this is not right, you must prove this, blah, blah.
Yes.
I don't know any IDE, Eclipse, NetBeans, IntelliJ, that would have taken your connection and automatically show this should be string comma integer. Let's do that.
Theory could have worked it out. The closest I ever saw was someone writing comments. Map open open comment angle brackets whatever close end comment, but that was like almost worse than not.
Okay. I see the process of how they evolved the features for Java 8 as being really different. The process inside of Oracle and previously inside of Sun has been quite different. I mean, what happened with generics was pretty pathological. I mean, there was quite a serious design for a lot of the time, and eventually it got out of control. And one guy essentially was responsible for a lot of the final facilities that went in there. For example, bounded types. That was really one person's idea. And in this case, what they've done, they're really conscious about this problem, and they've got a lot of feedback from developers and worked very hard to get feedback from developers on the features. And if we're talking about the future of the language, I think this is quite important. They're really conscious of the fact that, I mean, every decision is taken in the light of the fact that there are 8 million Java developers out there, and most of them aren't coming to conferences like this, and they really think quite hard about that, and how to make the facilities usable by the guys who are doing this outsourced code he's just complaining about.
What's the most complicated lambda feature, in your opinion?
Well, the real problem is that what I'm seeing at the moment, and it changes from day to day, what I'm seeing at the moment is that it's quite hard to understand how type inference works.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, you have to, you're complaining quite bitterly, why do I have to say all this stuff? The type inference algorithm is very, very powerful. But the problem is that it can't be applied consistently.
So can I just ask, what is type inference?
Oh, sorry, type inference is when it works out what the type of the lambda is, without you having to say...
Runnable portable.
Well, runnable is actually a very good example, because the problem with these, with type inference actually, they've done a really good job of it, but the problem is that in the context of overloading, it's really hard to work out which functional interface you're trying to do. And the problem about that is that they don't want to use the context to deduce the type of the lambda, because if you've got them nested, then you get an exponential combinatorial increasing the complexity. So they reduced the power of the type inference algorithm. And sometimes they've done it because people couldn't work out by looking at the code. They think about people reading the code, not people writing the code. They're not interested in that. If you couldn't read the code easily without the explicit types in there, they won't
infer
the types.
No,
that's what Scala suffers from.
Can I just mention for the sake of those listening on the recording, so if you take a triple executor, you know, executor service, and you say submit lambda, right? If you for example have got a body of code inside there which throws an exception, then you also have to have a return statement inside.
Yeah.
Because then infers it. The exception means you must have it must be causal.
Okay.
And
is that checked exception versus unchecked?
Yeah, checked exception. So like compile to drop exception.
So you can throw an unchecked exception, it's not a problem.
That's fine. But if it's a checked exception, then it has to have a return return. Even if it's returned not, it has to have a return. And whereas otherwise if you don't have a return, then it automatically assumes it's a runnable. Now, I thought it's quite clever that the thing is that with something like call and runnable, these are quite different in the way that they work. And I mean, I know now after doing it a few times that we have this, but if I look at a body of code, submit, squiggle, squiggle, and I will never know which it is. If I didn't know this, I mean, the normal program will never know what it is.
Right. Yeah. So that,
I don't know if it matters.
That's a very good example. Well, that's a very good example why a too powerful a type inference engine actually hurts you as a reader, because it allows the developer to miss out type information that you as a reader will actually need. So they don't want to do anything more clever than what people can do.
One case specifically in Java 8 where this is obvious, which is with the stream API, because you can have object streams and you can have int streams.
Yeah.
So the question is, are you doing an object stream with integer, or are you doing a stream with lowercase int?
Yeah.
Like, which of those versions is going to be used?
Performance, of course.
And that has huge performance implications.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest implications is people overusing parallel strings, because it's so easy to do. You know, you can do a parallel string with one, an element of one, or a very small number of elements, which won't actually be faster.
Because
that's a very common thing I see now, is that people who use parallel, it must be faster, they don't bother checking, and it's not. And making it even easier to write that is not necessarily a good thing.
So you have all the coordination of splitting and
carving and everything parallel. Boom.
Yeah, I've got multiple colors, how do I use them all? I've got lots of memory, how do I use it all? And usually my answer is, right, he's busy with waiting threads and go for it, it's done.
So here's the weirdest part for me. On the one hand, he introduced more of the computable future and the asynchronous processing. And on the other hand, you have the functional and stream API, but you can't do asynchronous streaming.
Why not?
What is the API for that?
Yeah.
If I want to do the stream API, but the source of that stream is asynchronously producing stuff, how do I do that?
One of the things that happened in Java 5 was that when they were developing multiple APIs at the same time, they didn't interact with each other because they were still both in flux. And it's quite possible that will happen in Java 8. If they're trying to develop two APIs at the same time, they won't necessarily use each other particularly well because neither of them existed before.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised
about
that.
So just to give you an example, the example would be like stream for each and then lambda, right? So if that's a synchronous call, so when a for each is done, the collection is done. I would want that for each to return a completion stage, but there's no way to do that.
Could you use a generator for that?
Sorry?
You could use a generator function to
because the for each returns void. I want it to return a completion state, so I can sort of hierarchize it, and it's sort of
easy.
Yeah.
Well, but you could set them into a collection and then start a new stream from there.
But the problem is that the source that is asynchronous.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, dragging people off. But if the source is asynchronous, why can't you encapsulate that in a generator function? and use that to generate the elements of the user. That to asynchronously generate the elements of the stream.
I guess to say more concrete, I don't understand why you can't do what you're saying.
I want something like the same API, but if you do stream for each, that means after that call finishes, the whole thing is done.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right. But if the stream source is like, it's coming elements here, there, and everywhere, I don't know when it's going to finish.
So why does it have to end?
No, it doesn't have to end, but when it ends, I would like to have a future that says...
But why does the stream have to end? You don't have to, just don't end.
But then that method call never finishes. I wanted that method call to finish.
But then you need to hand off, right?
The completion stage is the handoff. Like, whenever you're done with the streaming things, there's nothing more to do. Yeah, just notify this completion stage.
They'll take it offline.
My impression is that there are mechanisms to do that also with the current APIs. In my opinion, yes, the new APIs should help us to read the code, make it better, but possibly to make possible things that were not possible up to now. Just creating syntactic sugar, yes, thank you, but an experienced developer can do without.
You fill in a lot of the code I like Lambdas because they are changing people's thinking in a better direction than where it was before. It comes back to my earlier point. It's changing people's thinking new way, maybe forcing them to touch old code and redo them. That in itself could be a benefit.
One more point is what is Lambda and how is it about debugging or logging? So this is part, because I think this is some part that is will get lost as well.
Debugging in Scala is pretty tricky, but I think Java is a lot simpler.
I think it's a lot simpler, but Scala is just completely unreadable once you've done it right.
So as far as I know, in IntelliJ, debugging Lambda doesn't work.
Sorry?
In IntelliJ, debugging Lambda doesn't work because it doesn't have any variable information. So if you have a breakpoint, it's like there's no local variables, there's no sort of the captured variables.
Yeah, support, so
how deep is the code stack?
So what I understand, because I looked into the IntelliJ bug tracker, and they say there's no debug information, there's nothing we can do.
Well, it doesn't generate it.
Let me be sure this, so let's say bug that will be fixed.
So that's the compiler issue.
Compiler
generating the correct information.
Having Lambdas makes it much more difficult to debug compared to the old style Java programming.
For the moment.
It's a matter of the tools catching up. But I think it's shifting people's thinking in a better direction than generics did. Generics took people, I think, in the wrong direction.
One of the biggest problems with generics, which they did change with Lambdas, is the unwillingness to touch the JVM.
Yeah.
And they bent over backwards and did all sorts of things that which weren't very natural in generics, just to avoid having to touch the JVM and maximizing backward compatibility.
Yeah, sometimes it's nice to randomly reseed a team.
Whereas it looks like Oracle are less, they're still obviously quite conservative where the JVM is concerned, but they are willing to say, well, the JVM should understand these new features. And I think that's a big improvement.
In the end, they did touch the JVM. I mean, that attempt to avoid it. What the argument about generics was really about was binary compatibility.
Right.
And that's not going to rise yet. I think the way that they've retrofitted Lambdas into the existing interface, into the existing type system, is actually will make that pretty seamless. It's not really.
Do you know if there's any real attempts to sort of fix generics?
Yeah, absolutely. I keep on asking when are they going to introduce ratification.
I think it was on one of the slides from Mark Reinhold.
Yeah, it's not going to be Java 9.
No, it's going to be probably not, I'd say. Yeah.
But it's definitely on the radar because they can't really introduce proper type. I don't understand the reason for this. but I'm told that they can't introduce a proper function type in Java. At the moment, lambdas are really just a kind of, it's not really clear what their type is. They don't fit into the typing system in Java very well. We need a new function type, but we can't have it until generics are reified. So that's actually quite a, that's a driver for it. I think it will happen, but you know, it's years down the line.
So one discussion that me and Andres have like all the time is with the because we work at the same place, it's like with the introduction of lambdas and functional programming, you're getting closer to Scala, which he uses all the day. So the question is like, okay, does that make it easier for Java developers to start using Scala, or does it make it like less useful to change to Scala, which has, you know, plenty of support for that? Like which way would you?
My bet is that Scala has a lot more features in it and moves much more quickly than Java does. So by the time that Java has added this new feature and people are comfortable with it, I imagine Scala will have added 3 new features or 4 or something. So it's one of the benefits of Scala or Ruby is that they move much more quickly and they add a lot more features, less conservative about changes makes the language, which is plus and minus.
Double-edged sword there, because that means that you're only going to drag along the people who are capable of coping with that level of change or that rate of change, right? And the most enterprises are not capable of coping with that rate of change.
They struggle with the rate of change in Java.
Right, exactly.
I also think that in practical terms, you will have, yes, people will develop in Scala, but for large-scale projects, I'm trying to imagine how would I persuade someone at Deutsche Bank, for example, oh, guys, let's move from Java to Scala.
Like, how would that conversation?
How would my argumentation? What would my argumentation look like?
Right.
It won't, to make it simple. It won't happen. They are staying on Java, and people know Java. It's more of a question. What is the usage area of the language? Right. There are projects that are where I want to be productive, bring out new features quickly. But I also have it doesn't have to be a smaller scale project, but it needs to be an environment which has dedicated itself to Scala.
I have a question. What were the arguments to move from COBOL to Java?
I'm not that old. I don't know.
Less and less available developers that get more expensive.
but that's your point. Actually, and this brings the point against Scala, because you don't find COBOL developers, that's why you move to Java. But moving to Java to Scala, you have less developers.
At the moment, but maybe in the future.
But
it's not a numbers game. If you get much better Scala devs than you get Java devs, then maybe it's still a good trade-off.
If the leap isn't as big as it used to be as well,
it would need to be disruptive.
But still, what's the motivation? There's no disruptive motivation to move to Scala, really. It makes the argument harder, right?
Where I've seen Scala used is when the alternative would have been an in-house DSL, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to write your own custom language. That is way worse than at least using something that's kind of standard, kind of supported, reasonably well works, has tooling, rather than doing all of it yourself. I have seen one site where they had their own version of Python, where they did all their development, their own IDE for it, their own debugger, everything. They've developed it all from scratch. And they said, they told me I could be productive in just 12 months. Yeah. Which would be fantastic.
I think that there is not going to be very much interchange. Java is a blue-collar language. That's the way they think about it, and that's, you know, it's very much, it's a language for the masses. And Scala is I don't even think the people, the Scala enthusiasts, ever think that Scala is going to be a language for the masses.
Yeah.
So I really think it's separate audiences, and I think both the populations on both sides think that. And I think what Lambdas will do is it will actually make it clearer that Java's not, even though a blue-collar language, it's not actually stuck in the 19th century. It's staggered forward into the 20th century. And it'll actually reduce, I know that the designers of Lambdas are thinking, well, it's going to prevent the kind of leakage of people over to Scala, because Java doesn't even have Lambdas, so they won't be able to say that anymore. They'll say, okay, well, we'll say that it's crap, but you know, it's got Lambdas.
I think that is... if we had Lambdas, back when I started working with Scala, I don't think I would have picked up Scala Mesh.
Yeah, because when I look at your code, that seems to be one of the key things that you're definitely using.
Yeah, of course. That's
it is important for that. But also, I thought maybe a question on a bit of a different note. I've been thinking a lot. Also, Maurice, you gave me yesterday an example of how to do with strings. And just for fun, I programmed that same example in Ruby.
Uh-huh.
And that evening, it was two lines of code, and they were this long. Mm-hmm. And when you look at them, you don't need to think what's going on. They work. You won't get them parallelized, for example. So, but the question is, that's why I want to ask this question. In Java, your syntax and the language allows you to do everything, very complex stuff. And in 80% of the cases, people don't use that stuff, but it's there, and it makes the language complex because it needs to do everything. All the other languages, Scala, Ruby, PHP, name it, they will say, okay, you don't need to do everything. Maybe it will be less efficient, but for that it will be more expressive, more readable, whatnot. And what is the thinking in behind Java creation process when people think about that? Because we also this finals discussion was interesting thing, because in most of the cases, yes, you won't need to declare effective final. So you say just integer something, mm-hmm, and it's effectively final. So in some of the cases, people will say integer something, use it where it needs to be effectively final, and try to change it before, and they will get an error. They won't know what's happening. So, what is this happening? But in 90% of the cases, it will do the work just fine.
I would disagree with that idea, because let's say when you go back to history where Java started, if you would think about that in Java, so just solving a small part, you would sit here not talking about Java, but talking about C, C++, because the aim of Java was making C or programming easy. So, and avoiding lots of pitfalls you have with this part. And
sure, that was a lot of the arguments for why you take Java and C++ also carry on to even higher level languages. You get the same arguments again. You know, that it's more productive, easy, you know, and you have less pitfalls, hopefully, and they tend to carry on to the more higher level languages as well. It's a matter of where you see the sweet spot, where's the best balance. For me, the best balance is Java, but I don't think that's true for every project.
Yeah, I could agree. I think that you find if you do an analysis of languages and stuff like that, you can see that there's probably only like two or maybe three features that are different between languages that make them difficult to use and difficult to reach, and cause all kinds of other difficulties that these other languages don't have that actually make them better suited for general purpose development. You know, certainly managed memory and removal of having to deal with pointers makes that class of language is much more easily reachable to the average developer than C++ does. And there's just, I think Cameron Purdy put this into a talk a couple of years ago where he said, there's just certain things that we have in the industry right now, like, application servers, right? Application servers work, everybody's bought into them because we know they're not going to say, well, because somebody added a component to it that, does something strange like this, right?
That lowers the threshold of quality you need to include a third-party library.
Right.
And so you can take a third-party library in Java and no matter how bad it is, it can only do certain things wrong. Whereas in C++, it can do anything.
And it can really damage your runtime.
So you're much more likely not to accept a third-party library, even from a commercial vendor, because you don't really know what it might do if a bug occurs.
Right. And there goes your component market. Right, just really like your EJB component market. I mean, everybody bitches about EJB component, JD things, right? But it really provided a framework that people didn't have to specify in terms of the deployment environment, which means that now I can take that chunk of work and outsource it without having to specify all the stuff that everyone was really pathetically bad at specifying anyways, right? And even the experts, if you look at the JD spec, were really not all that wonderful in specifying it.
And you can write really horrible code, but there's only so much damage you can do to the rest of your application by doing that.
But you can do that in Ruby and Scala also. I don't get your argument that that you have to, that languages have to be limited in order to be simple.
Exactly.
Because certainly there's a couple of ideas that in Java, if you just sort of like invert them again, and then you can do an incredible amount of simplification of the Java language, and it still have it maintained as a general purpose language. I don't think Scala is not a special language. You can use it general purpose.
I didn't quite get what you said.
I actually wasn't targeted at a feature set. I was targeting the expressiveness and simplicity of the language. And I'm not saying that Java needs to cover everything. Yes, Java needs to offer the function set that it's offering.
Sure.
But the for example, in a lot of places, I'm wondering. The expression that I write is very complex. It's just difficult to read. Or when I read code from someone else, I need to look at it from a lot of different sides to understand what is he actually saying with this. And yes, you do understand it in the end, but there are more languages where it's much more intuitive, much simpler. You just look at it, of course, go on. It's self-documenting as well. And I'm saying in Java that there needs to be also a decision, yes, I need this in order to enable this feature set, but I also could say I will make stuff that covers 80% of the uses much simpler, and for the last 20%, you'll need to do a great deal of complexity. That will become increasingly complex, but on the other hand, not everyone is using it. So I can actually move that complexity a bit away. And I'm trying to figure out where the thinking is there. What's the way of thinking behind that?
My feeling is that a lot of it still comes back. There's the features of the language and the style of the language, and then there's the nature of the way a lot of developers write in that language. And they're interrelated in the sense that you can write easy, readable code in Java, but there are certain features of certain languages which encourage you to write more crafted code.
Yeah.
And so you get this feedback loop between the two of them, right? If you're used to dealing with APIs and they're all quite chunky and they're a bit clumsy, then you're used to accepting and writing clumsy code, and so then you end up with this just sort of knock-on effect. If you're used to writing, say, in Scala, where it's got all these nice operators and it hides away a lot of the complexity and detail by using all these symbols, you're going to tend to use that and write that way yourself. So it's not that you can't do it in Java, it's that there are some features of the Java and the API which sort of tend to encourage people or seem to attract people that don't write as elegant or crafted code.
It's a culture thing too.
Yeah, so
and it's an educational thing. It's an educational thing, yeah.
Yeah,
I think a lot of universities still teach procedurally, very procedurally, and that comes out in some of these, especially from new grads coming up, right? They don't know how to structure, and they don't know how to really invert the control, and this really comes from education.
And then all libraries have get to incentives, we need to have get to incentives.
Yes, and then they're automatically generated, as soon as you create the class, it's just...
Why do they need to be there in the first place?
Well, they shouldn't be there in the first place.
A lot of developers
without writing
in the Java space.
And I was forced to write them 6 years ago.
So many developers in the Java space are just happy to get code that works, that they just leave it at that. Once it's worked, that's done.
Yeah.
Whereas they're not able to think on a higher level and think, well, actually, how can I make this as readable as possible? How do I craft this? After I finish all this, is half the things I was doing no longer necessary? Can I take that out? And you need to have that phase of, well, what can I take out of this? How can I make it clearer? What can I remove? What can I rename? Like, I gave it a bad name to start with. Now I've changed its functionality. Can I give it a more meaningful name now? Going back and refactoring the code as you're doing it. Exactly. They're just having to be done. And if half the things that they did along the way are no longer needed, they'll leave them in there.
But I mean, coming back to Rita's example, I think you were targeting at this. I'm always asking the question, I would. I mean, for example, this getter and setter example. I don't want to write class public int, people go at it, just change it. So I do want to have a point where I can control how it's changed or how it's read. And but why can't Java just assume if I write private, I could have a, another modifier saying, just assume that I have getter and setter. If I write it in the code, it's there. If I don't write it, just go directly at the attribute.
Like C-sharp.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's probably why people can't agree what properties are really.
Yeah.
Properties are one thing for one half of the developers and another thing for the other half of the developers. So they decided to lock them in properties up till now.
Because the way that the GUI people want to define properties, as opposed to the way the server side developers want to define, they're completely different.
Yeah.
And it all, you know, and this is why, like, looking at FX, they're going like, okay, great. Now, finally, you know, those guys will go away and leave us alone because they're going to be able to get what they want in a language that is expressive and libraries are expressive to the way that they do things, and then we can just define something that works with the way that we do things. Or because GUI and server code is inherently very different, right? Like, so whereas you want good encapsulation and you want control of external state in server code, GUI is about exposing external state. So it's a completely opposite activity. Mm-hmm. And you can actually, if you do software metric studies of code bases, right, you can, just from the metrics, you can pick out the GUI code from the regular code just by because the metrics just come out differently because they reflect, you know, the differences in how these things are built.
One of the points of lambdas also is that lambdas in GUI code is a lot nicer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not that I write.
So on the APIs are especially designed to fit and play nicely with Lambda. So they have a lot of generics all over the place. And what was type inference, playing in the Lambda, so just end up writing just your business logic code. So no ceremonies.
Yeah.
So that's really nice.
And Bruno, for your first question about that constructor, I think that something like named parameters are enough for your thing. So it's not necessary to write name is something, but constructor with name equal something. I think that could be good.
Whatever syntax you use. That was an example that I also suffer from regularly. You look at a method, I pass seven parameters. Okay, you could argue, why don't I have a value object that I'm passing? Mm-hmm. Good.
Yes.
So let's put that aside. I just pass three. I don't create value objects for three. But three, if there are three booleans, true, false, true.
Cool.
What was that?
So what's a value object?
I just create an object that I was passing.
Structure.
So what you're saying is that you have bad design because you have missing abstractions in your code and you have to substitute value objects.
That's a good point.
But this is seriously a metric that you should fail to build on.
But that's why I changed it and gave it a different example.
Yeah.
So you read the code, there is true, false, true. What was that once again? Yes, I mean, you will find them immediately. You go into the signature, either control, click it, or just move your mouse, get the Java doc, you will get it. But why don't I just see it?
The problem is when you have another constructor that takes it as well three booleans, but they are three other things.
Or
then you
have things in a different order.
But then you use internet initializers, and you don't have this problem.
But then don't use booleans.
There are two different. One is the craft, and one is what the tools give you. And sure, the craft is really important. Discipline and learning is super important. But the language can help you. Syntax. I love sugar. I have sugar in my coffee every day. I like it.
Yeah, but in this case, nobody prevents you from using an ENIAC. An ENIAC with the meaning. And
it's not
that.
I can just constants. I will go around this in practice. But you need to realize, as I said right now, if it's there, people will use it by default. And I don't think constants are the problem. That's actually the problem of that one is when we are sitting and saying, hey, this is boilerplate, and we don't need it, why don't I just write it? You know, that's a really excellent idea. Or just take without names, going too through because I know what it is, but that's
I would say do stuff, yes, do stuff or not do stuff. I'll make constants out of it so it makes it more readable. And it's again something that I think about. I have to place somewhere. I have to.
Yeah, but
there will be another
thinking
person.
You don't really think it's actually, but thinking is good.
Yeah.
Yes, but yeah, I would like to think about different things.
But it's unnecessary. It's a tax. You have to pay it, although it doesn't give you anything.
I discovered that probably because enums came a bit late in Java language, they are not used as they were using C. In C, for example, I was using enums always, even replacing integers.
Right, because you didn't have proper objects to work with. And if you use proper objects, you find that you don't use enums.
Yeah. Yeah, but in case instead of using conflicts, I prefer using enums.
Fair enough. Okay.
Connection open close.
Again, when I run into enums, in the majority of the cases, I find there's missing abstractions in the model that would cause you to not actually need the enums, right? There's a structuring. The excessive use of these is an indication of structural problems in the code to begin with,
mm-hmm.
You know? And really what you need to do is go address the problems instead of papering over them, right? So you have problems of acceptance testing from your vendors and from wherever you get your third-party code got from, right? Because, you know, a lot of this code in, you can't control the quality of it coming in, but you can certainly set standards. And if they know what the standards are, right, and you have a clear idea what the standards are, you can test for them. And this is like the lost art of actually using code metrics to understand what's going on, right? Everybody says, okay, we want our code to be loosely coupled. Anybody here have a tool that measures coupling?
Yeah, I use it.
Right? You use it.
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what class cohesion is?
Yes.
Right? Okay. Do you have a tool for measuring it?
Same tool.
Same tool. Right? Which tool are you using?
It's Sonar. It uses some other tool inside. I tried to look it up.
So you're using Sonar. Okay. So, right? Are you getting Halstead?
Nope.
Right? Okay. So then, you know, there's all kinds of different pieces of information that you get from, like, all the Halstead metrics, right? Right? And if you start going through the list of metrics that you can use, you can do a cursory level understanding of, like, what's the code quality here? What's the design quality? You know? And just based on that, you can object or reject, right? Number of parameters in a method call. Right? Which is make a histogram of it. What's going on there? These are just simple counts that you can do in the code base that's going to tell you what's going on.
For me?
It's
yes.
Too depressing.
Yes.
It's too depressing.
I've actually used your code as a standard in one example, right? So that took like projects that you had actually contributed to accidentally and some others, and you showed how good the in-house stuff was compared to what you had done. Right? And the metrics came out approximately about twice as bad as what you had. So.
Oh, so I was okay.
You were okay.
Any recommendations?
You can't have tools to replace craftsmanship. That's the only.
You're a gentleman, you can't remove any code. Could you contribute to the page of this talk about your tool? Check and then write it down.
You mean the tool to check that?
Yes, for cohesion and coupling. I mean, you did not
remember. Look up
Sonar. And then there's Structure 101.
There are a couple of other tools that do that. Just if you type in Java code matrix, that would be the first one. That
mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to make it to your tool.
I'm
right. Very worried. Structure 101 is pretty.
Mm-hmm. I think the difficulty is to understand the metrics. You generate them, you see some numbers, and they don't tell you anything. You need to kind of track them over.
Yes.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
They don't tell you anything because you, if they're not telling you something, if the metrics are not telling you something, it's probably because you don't understand what the measure actually means.
Yeah, you actually have to experience in understanding.
Well, yeah, I completely agree. So you're going to have to look at them, but you're going to have to go and say, okay, what does this actually mean? What does this actually imply in my code base, right? So, you know, what's a class cohesion value of 3 mean? Yeah. Okay.
What does it mean? You can however track it over time.
Yeah, of course. You can track it over time also.
But
yeah.
For me, always the matrix is something that
deals
is something that deals with the problem. But I would like to. I'd like to.